Now that my book, I've Got Something to Say, has been out for 3 months, it's time to step back, survey the grounds, and enjoy the spoils of a project that took about 2 years to see to fruition. Even though the book is a collection of my various essays I've written for rock magazines, it was very much a collaborative project. I worked with 12 illustrators. Only 3 were from my hometown of Toronto. I worked with layout designer Ingrid Paulson. I worked with Mount Sinaid and Biblical member Nick Sewell on layout as well. I asked Duff McKagan to write the foreword. I continue to work with the good people at Feral House who published the book. But out of all these people, the first person I asked on board this project was Aaron Brophy, my old editor at the Huffington Post. It was a big ask for a couple of reasons. I was trepidatious because I didn't know how Aaron would receive the request. In my head, I wasn't so sure the word book and the word author even went alongside my name. Would he laugh the idea into oblivion? Would he even have the time if he didn't? Asking Aaron also meant this idea of putting out a book I'd had festering for some time in my head was now something I had to make into a real thing. You see, the moment I asked someone to join me on this project, to me, meant it was now not going to stop until it was finished one way or another. And thankfully, Aaron not only agreed, but seemed genuinely excited to work on the book. That gave me a little boost of confidence, and the two of us hunkered down for months, going through my essays, Aaron reading each one and giving me unfiltered opinions and occasionally ruthless edits, until we had hacked and slashed and carved out the raw shape of the book. The two of us worked smoothly in tandem, and I couldn't have asked for a better editor. I met Aaron sometime in the late 90s, when he was the editor-in-chief of Canada's Chart magazine, one of the country's only music magazines, and Aaron's wide musical taste bent backwards towards heavy music, something I always quietly noted. In my home country of Canada, I find music journalists will feign interest in heavy music to appear well-rounded, but further inspection will usually reveal the opposite. I'm fine with that, but when I find people like Aaron, someone who can hang on either side, I tend to stick close. And that was another thing. Aaron and I do get along quite well, as you will hear on this episode. That was definitely crucial. I can't work with someone who could do the job, but couldn't quite get the references or the humor contained in the book. I needed someone who was on the same page. Aaron was on both pages, so to speak. The relationship between writer and musician has always been a cautious one. With similar interests, but in different streams, it's natural to assume the two sides could and would eventually become friends, but musicians are wary of getting burned or exposed if they get too close, and writers are wary of becoming too biased in favor of the musician if they get too close. So it gets to be an awkward tango between two parties that are usually awkward to begin with. For me, I've been equally burned by writers and musicians, so I'm cautious around both sides. Letting my guard down and gaining my trust takes a long time. When it comes to the music biz, I haven't placed my trust in too many people. So the release and positive response the book has received only goes to show how effective Aaron and I work together. And my instincts were right to place trust in Aaron's editorial skillsmanship? Anyway, I'm sure Aaron would edit that word out. I guess this conversation was meant to be about the book, and it is, briefly, before heading straight into a broader conversation about music and music writing. I just wanted to mention here, although it may sound out of left field, but it's Kelly Hansen who sings for Foreigner these days, and who used to be in Hurricane, a band I hadn't really given much thought since their albums in the 80s. Sounds odd to say here, and I mention it only here because I couldn't remember Kelly's last name, nor could I remember his old band while Aaron and I chatted, and it bugged the hell out of me after we finished the episode. Listen on to understand why. I guess I should plug the book here too, since Aaron is such a big part of it. You can visit feralhouse.com. You can buy it on Amazon. In Canada, you can buy it at all Indigo Books and wherever cool books are sold. And in Europe, you can order it through Turnaround Books out of the UK. When we'll be on tour this November and December in Europe, we will have copies for sale at our merch booth too. I'd buy it because, as far as I've seen, everyone who has a copy loves it. Okay, here goes. Aaron Brophy, editor of I've Got Something to Say, which is my first book, is on the podcast, and it starts now. The Take Your Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flynn, get his tankers, go out to love for free. I'm sad, but I like to sometimes. Jimmy in from fucked up. Stop playing. Hang down, down. The googly gaggly goblins will make sure they get their podcast fill by listening to Danko Jones, then snacking on some broken bones. And scaredy cats will run amok when rock and roll starts to talk, flapping gums and striking tongues. A chilly podcast has now begun.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get ready because the Danko Jones podcast starts now!
Hey, Aaron, it's great to have you on the podcast finally.
Yes, I feel we've been talking about this forever.
Forever, really years and years, years and years. Yeah. The podcast has been going on for 7 years come this fall, and we've probably been talking about it for six.
Yeah, maybe eight.
Yeah, right. But it's good you're finally here. There is an occasion to have you on.
Indeed.
You are the editor. You edited my book, my first and only, well, only and first... my book, my one book, I've Got Something to Say. And we worked on this project together for a year and a half.
It was surprising to me how long it took. And I've done tons of stuff like this, although not exactly books. You know, I'm a magazine person. And I was shocked at how long just doing that exact same thing in book form takes.
Yeah, I mean, even when I submitted the completed version to Feral House, I thought it was going to come out in like 3 months, like a record. But
yeah,
it was actually more like 8-9 months later, 10 months even. I can't remember the timeline exactly, but all I remember was, wow, that's far away.
Yeah, and you were ahead of the curve because you already had a completed book ready to submit to publishers too. So think about how long the curve is if someone goes, hey Danko, your book was great, we want you to write another one, start from scratch, you know. And that's, what's that process, 2 years, you know, unless you really churn it out.
Yeah, exactly. So. At that point, when the two of us had kind of finished the project, you know, unbeknownst to Feral House or anybody, when it was done between the two of us, I was all ready to go the self-publishing route, which I'm still assuming would have taken half the time, like 4 or 5 months.
Yeah, I can't imagine it wouldn't be quicker.
Yeah.
And I totally understand that fierce independent streak, but I suspect you landed at a good spot in a good home with this book.
Oh, if someone had told me that this book we'd be working on would be on Feral House, I would have freaked out. Mm-hmm. It would have actually really altered the way I thought of the project. I would have been too self-conscious because I love Feral House as a entity. So it worked out. It couldn't have worked out better being on Feral House.
You would have also had to rewrite the book with 3 stories about conspiracy theories, 2 about aliens, 1 about
Satan.
You know, yeah.
Which is the real draw for me. Let's put it this way. The first Feral House book I ever got was the biography on Anton LaVey. So that, it's what drew me to the company. So and that's what they really focus on, just really outsider stuff, whether it's a lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of just odd characters, and I feel honored to sit alongside some of these people that have written and that are written about in the Ferrell House catalog.
Yeah. I like to use the term rich tapestry.
When I realized that, hey, you know, I think I could do this book and make this be a thing, which is always something I've had in the back of my mind, but I'm never going to write an autobiography. That doesn't interest me. But this kind of collection of essays did, and I was trying to, I didn't think about it too long. You were always someone who was in the back of my mind that I had kind of long tapped as editor for whatever project I was going to do in sort of this kind of literary form. And I think I remember you were my editor for when I wrote for the Huffington Post.
Correct. Yeah.
And I remember you asked me to write, and I remember when I finally submitted my first column and it had been given the green light, I wrote you an email and I said, there's always been this feeling I've had in the back of my head where I always thought you would be my editor. It's a weird feeling. It's the same feeling I had when I met JC mm-hmm. in front of the Elma Combo for the first time. This is like early 90s.
What show would have that been for?
It was, I believe, it was William Neu had those Tuesday nights.
Oh.
What were they called?
I can't remember. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, the William Neu open stage for bands nights, mm-hmm. whatever that was called. Oh, my God. That was like a staple on the Toronto scene. I can't even remember the name of it.
Yeah.
But I met him in front of the Elma Combo there.
Yeah.
And I got a very distinct feeling that I would work with him somehow. And that's the same feeling I got when, we finally did this first Huffington piece thing where you edited my article. So when it came time to do this book and I needed an editor, of course, not just proximity-wise, because you literally live across the street from me, but seriously.
Four minutes apart.
Yeah. You left your place, like, we were meeting at 11. You left at 10:56, I'm assuming. So, but not because of that, but because I always kind of knew, had this feeling that you would be my editor somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So it made perfect sense. You know, it was easy that we would have meetings down the street. So, but other than that, it was always supposed to be, I guess.
Yeah, it's cosmic.
Cosmic. backtrack. You were the editor of Huffington Post, but I met you when you were the editor of Chart Magazine.
Yep. Yeah, rest in peace, Chart Magazine. That was, I had a couple, journalism and media publishing jobs before that, but that was my first big gig working for Chart Magazine, which was a monthly national newsstand music magazine. It was... we took ourselves pretty seriously. We punched above our weight. We competed for a Canadian magazine. We competed against, Rolling Stone and AP and Spin and Q and all of those, like, on newsstands against that type of, publication. And then we also started a website, Chart Attack, which...
that was very successful, right?
It was screamingly successful, at least content-wise, and, we churned out a ton of stuff, and we were really good at it. We had a huge network of people. We were doing tons of content every day, like good stuff too.
Yeah, I checked it. I think I checked it like daily at some period.
Yeah, there was a point when we were really rolling, and then we just didn't have the money to sustain it. And
it was like a blabbermouth thing. You had like a daily news note thing.
Yeah, there would usually be up to about 10 stories a day, and then be some of it would be just like press release rips, and but there would be feature interviews, and there'd be, you know, premieres and all the standard stuff. But for a bunch of a small plucky Canadian publication, we were, you know, we were pretty good at knowing how to make international stories, and we would hit quite regularly with some good stuff.
Did anything that you guys cover or post hit internationally? Like,
constantly.
They pick it up?
A good example would be, I don't know, Oasis comes to town and they do a half dozen interviews. So we get one slot, you know, and we'd use our slot to maybe ask a specific type of outlandish question that maybe Canadian press wouldn't ask, or the Star wouldn't ask, or the Sun wouldn't ask, you know, like the regular, more serious people wouldn't ask. So we'd do our serious interview with the members of Oasis, but then ask two or three like oddball questions, or like a really targeted, maybe this could be cause a scandalous answer. And then if we got the scandalous answer, we'd package that up as a separate news story, put that out there, and then all of a sudden all of England steals that story. And then all of a sudden, you know, maybe it, you know, people in the US steal that story and say it could be Liam Gallagher told, you know, a Canadian publication that Robbie Williams should be set on fire, and, you know, or whatever the outlandish thing they say, because all they do, Oasis, all they do is just say intentionally outlandish things to specifically cause that ripple.
Right.
So all you have to do was plan for it and sort of strategize for it, and you could get all kinds of those sorts of things.
Were there other bands who didn't play the game like Oasis did that ended up, you know, you being the source for an international story?
Like just being terrible interviews,
or just anything that got some traction. Not Oasis is like they're known. They have a reputation for being, you know, saying outlandish stuff. But was there something like, I don't know, you're interviewing Norah Jones and then she said, "Oh, I don't, you know, I like, you know, I don't know."
Because we did so many interviews with so many different types of people that we got the full spectrum of responses and full spectrum of, like, you know, could be a great, really insightful interview, could be an absolutely terrible, you could tell this person was just hitting their, I just got media trained and I'm gonna say my three media points. It's a, we're really excited about this record, we feel it's a homecoming. It's like, what the fuck does that mean? But that's it. It's mentioned four times in their bio, and then they say the same thing
Call them out when they do that
sometimes, but what's the point in calling them out? Because if they're only going to give you, you know, their sort of official standard responses, that's all you're gonna get anyway, right? Like, you get interviewed all the time, you must have a general idea of who you might want to give a little bit more juice to and who you don't. And it becomes really obvious really quick. Like, do they seem like they have good questions? Do they have maybe, they don't necessarily need to have a good personality, because most music media are just, you know, blocks of wood of horrible people. And I say that being, one of them. But, you know, if they've, you know, say they got a bit of charm, or, you know, got good questions, or you know they're knowledgeable, or they hit you with a good point, you're probably going to give them a little something.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. It's been when you sit down for an interview thinking it's just another interview, and the interviewer hits you with like a deep question, or you know, references a band that they would know you like, or you know a lot about. So that kind of puts it into another realm. Yeah. The interview takes on a different kind of vibe.
Yeah.
And that's an interviewer that is prepared and researched. Yeah. I don't say this to mean that, yeah, I like to do interviews with people who kiss my ass or who research me, but your job is to research the subject, whatever it is. And so I think I was told like, now it's 14 years ago that I need media training. By a little late now.
Yeah,
by a publicist of ours who's definitely that was short lived, but she insisted that I needed media training, and here I am thinking, and she did it on the eve of me doing a week and a half press tour in Europe. So what a way to send me off completely insecure.
Yeah,
I started questioning myself because I'm. In essence, you know, representing the other guys in the band and representing, you know, this project with this new album that we worked hard on. And you're really taking the wind out of my sails and questioning whether I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And in the end, it was because I feel, like I would just run my mouth and I'd say whatever I wanted to say. And I wouldn't say those stock answers that, and isn't that what you expect from someone?
And I would argue, when you don't give the stock answers, that's the reason why a year later, when you come back in town with another record, that you get another another interview.
Yeah.
Because if you give us the boring answers and the boring interview topics, and you're not A++ list.
Right.
You know, if you're A++, you can give the shittiest one-line answers, and those become news. It's shocking to me. Like, Lady Gaga says, "I like music." I'm like, and that becomes an internationally, you know, quoted quote. It's like, what the shit? It's like, I also like music. Does that go viral? You know, but if you're below that tier,
you gotta work it.
Yeah, gotta. If you're not interesting, those interview ops are going to dry up, and then your media dries up, and then what do you got?
Yeah, I really, that was, that the way you phrased that answer was kind of my argument to what she was trying to push onto me. Mm-hmm. But it fell on deaf ears. In the end, I was like, no way, there's just no way I can do this. And so I never showed up. I actually sent the person who was supposed to media train me, I sent her like interview clips. Mm-hmm. Kind of pleading my case with someone who we're supposed to be getting our money, and even she said, "Yeah, I don't think you need this." Mm-hmm. So in the end, it was just a power play, I think.
Yeah,
this person in our band, and what ended up happening was I was under so much stress, I got a condition in my eye called CSR, which is central serous retinopathy, which just 11 years ago it happened, and it just came back last month. Which is blindness in the eye, partial blindness for 3 weeks.
Damn.
Yeah. And so that's how much I really clung to this idea that I think I know what I'm doing when it comes to interviews. But anyways, you have a lot of experience with interviews, essays, editing, articles. You were the perfect choice to have you edit this collection.
Pretty excited when you asked me to do this because I don't get to do many things like this anymore, but I was stoked and I think it turned out great. I'm thoroughly entertained by the book, but I am a biased audience. So.
Well, you know what? I think I told you maybe, or maybe I kept it to myself, that I was super nervous about the book's release, more so than any record of ours. I'm not even nervous when those come out. Because it's been like a record has been vetted through so many ears. It's just, but it was just you and me, really, just working secretively via email and what's that app that
Google Sheets.
Google Sheets. Yeah. And so I had no idea. And it's hard to get people to read a book rather than listen to an album to get their quick opinion on it. So, but since it's been out, which is now like 2.5 months, I'd say 100% positive feedback. Mm-hmm. And if there's any negative feedback, they're being real quiet about it.
Yeah.
So I'm happy.
I'm stoked on your behalf. Anytime you retweet or Instagram someone, and it'll be like, I don't know, the guy from White Lion just got my book, and
I think you mean Mr. Big, because that was what happened.
I saw that one. I was trying to come up with another one, right. Who could I one up from?
Yeah,
you know, White Lion, the Sea Hags,
Mike Tramp, yeah. Mike Tramp from White Lion. I've never met Mike Tramp though. I'd love to though, man. I'm a big White Lion fan. But yeah, Eric Martin from Mr. Big the Singer, he now has a copy of I've Got Something to Say. And so yeah, it's been like that. You know, it's hard to read a book for people rather compared to like listening to an album.
Yep.
You can finish it in 30, 40 minutes, whereas a book, you just, oh, God.
No, it's an actual commitment, especially in 2018 versus Netflix, video games, you know, Spotify, podcasts, you know, TV, whatever you want to do, hot yoga. I don't do hot yoga.
Scrapbooking.
Yeah.
I've been currently trying to get through this one book for like a month.
Yeah.
And every time I read three pages, I'm like, oh, I got to, did I just get an email? Did I hear that little bell that says I get an email? And then I put it down for another day. So yeah, it's hard to get through these days. So anyone who finishes the book and they've posted, people have posted and tweeted about finishing the book, I'm super impressed. Mm-hmm. And they usually also add that they enjoyed it. So I'm happy about that.
Then that's the victory. Has anybody been giving any feedback on what their favorite stories were?
Yeah. Dungeons and Dragons has, a couple of people have said the Dungeons and Dragons essay.
I love that story. It's mostly because I love the idea of it. I love like taking a thing that's already a game about your imagination and, you know, you're making it bigger and adding a whole new layer to it.
Yeah.
I appreciate that as an idea. And then your systematic nature of doing it, I'm like, I get that. I understand that. Yeah. That too.
Well, that's another reason that I think it was great to work with you, is you have such a wide, open love of music. So if I throw a Saxon reference to you, you know, even though you're a music guy, you would still get that reference.
Yeah.
A lot of people in music, pundits even, wouldn't know, like, if I say, hey, you know, who do you like better, Hammerfall or Saxon? They would just be clueless.
I just saw, was it Saxon opening for Judas Priest this last tour in London, Ontario.
Yeah.
And that place is...
Was it the London Music Hall? Or no, it
had to whatever be the arena is.
Oh, the arena. Right. Yeah.
So,
wow. I wish I saw that.
I was pretty happy I saw it. I love Priest. We might be getting near end of days for that band. Doesn't quite feel as... I just raised a metal fist there for anybody, you know, as it used to be.
The metal community felt it.
Yeah.
I was under the impression this is the last one, because Glenn Tipton is out of the band now too. So the KK and Glenn are out of the band. Like, Halford and Hill are the only ones left.
Yeah.
And even though Halford's Priest to me, so is Tipton. Mm-hmm. It's like having Robert Plant without Jimmy Page.
I saw Robert Plant recently too, but I can probably go on and on about that, because I've spent all of my last calendar year seeing as many classic rock acts as I can, because I have this thing called a Before They Die list, and I try to knock off all these bands. Yeah.
Interesting you would bring this up, because Aretha Franklin is apparently on her deathbed.
Yeah. As we speak, she's on her deathbed. She's on my list. She had a show scheduled for the Toronto Jazz Festival this summer, and then she canceled it. And I was like, man, I'm not going to get many other chances. I had her on my radar to go see. And if you read the tea leaves, yeah, ain't going to get another chance to see her.
Yeah. I had tickets for Aretha Franklin. What was it, in 03?
Mm-hmm.
Whenever SARS hit.
Oh.
And someone in my family had SARS. So I was in quarantine, so I couldn't go to the show.
Yeah.
So that's definitely someone on the list. When I hear about it, I go, oh, damn.
Missed opportunity.
Yeah.
My all-time number one was Chuck Berry. And I knew he would... It would, my chances were slim, because when I started thinking about doing this list, he's already, I don't know, 80 something or however old he was, and he would occasionally do a monthly residency show at a club in St. Louis.
We
it was like
that
called
club.
Blueberry Hill or something.
Yeah,
like
we
that.
Played that club.
Okay. So yeah, he would show up there, and I had a small army of people who were ready and willing to drop anything to, like, if they heard this another show was going to go down, we were going to road trip down there and go see it, because it had reached the point where he had stopped doing these residencies, which I also was like, all right,
that's it.
Pretty clear sign.
But that, was he still playing?
No.
Like once a year in the summer or something. With Jerry Lee Lewis or something like that.
The last, I remember looking at his last appearance there, the set list was just all question marks. Like, and they were question marks because apparently it was a question marky set. And I'm like, that still would have been worth, you know, the multi-hour drive road trip for me to see, even if it was just to see an old man who's incapable of executing most basic musical things, just to, like, do my, you know, pay homage to, you know, the king of rock and roll. Mm-hmm. It would have been worth it, but never got that opportunity.
It's interesting we're talking about this, because just yesterday I was thinking about this, and I was playing a Lonnie Smith album.
Mm-hmm.
I just found it through Spotify. I was just, you know, just searching. I'm like, oh, Lonnie Smith. I haven't heard Lonnie Smith in years. And it reminded me of the first time that I went to New York City. We were set to record with Jerry Teal of the Chrome Cranks, Honeymoon Killers. Mm-hmm. And we brought with us, we were coming from D.C., we brought with us Michelle May of The Makeup.
Okay.
She came with us. She was in our van.
That's random.
Yeah, and she ended up being singing on the session as well. And it's a song we've never released, actually. We should, but we've never released. And the first night, we drove in, and we got a Village Voice, and we just looked at the listings, and it blew me away. Everyone, you could see Sonic Youth here, you could see Cool Keith here, you could see, you know, I don't know, you know, Radiohead playing the big room. But then at the Village Vanguard, it was Lou Donaldson and Lonnie Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went. There was hardly anyone there. I mean, it wasn't a full house, standing room only.
Yeah.
We had seats, and I saw Lou Donaldson and Lonnie Smith play the first night I was ever in New York City, and I was just buzzing from, I couldn't even take in the jazz. And at that time, we're talking like mid-90s, I had an appreciation for jazz, but I never really acclimated to it. You know, like, you know, I was, you know, but since then, of course, I've definitely come to love it.
Mm-hmm.
But watching, I just knew who they were. And mainly from going through jazz records at Rotate and wherever, just going, why don't I like this? You know, and just trying to familiarize myself with all these cats, and to use a jazz term. And man, I didn't know what I was watching at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm never going to see that again. But what I was thinking, my point is, when you go to New York City now, is, if you look through the listings, would it be the same? Would you be as like excited because this person, this legend is playing here, this legendary band's playing there? I don't think it's like that anymore, is it?
You know what? I'm sure if I went there and looked at the listings, I would still find 10 things where I'm like, oh, we could see this, we could see that, we could see...
Yeah, you could see like, okay, Cat Power is playing here, and but Cat Power is going to play here anyways. But like, Cool Keith and Lou Donaldson. And
right, but there is always those type of acts. Like, you're talking about like weird underplays where only, they're not weird underplays. It's like a club show where there's 70 people there and it's, you know, super fans of like some underappreciated genius. We can find those every day in Toronto. We're just immune to them. You know, like in Toronto, because we know everybody here, and like we see them. Like I don't know. I'm trying to think of a good example.
Stompin' Tom.
Well, you're not gonna see any shows from him anytime. Oh, here's a great example. You go to the Cameron House in the middle of the week, the middle of the afternoon, like or early evening, and they've usually got like some form of house country band playing, and you walk in and they're like, wow, those guys are pretty crack players. And you find out, you know, oh, it's Basil Donovan from Blue Rodeo. Mm-hmm. It's someone else from some other band.
Right.
And a couple of the Sadies are there. And,
right.
And it's like, that's a superstar band, but they're playing to 30 people on a Wednesday at 7 p.m. or something,
right?
After work crowd. Like those gigs always exist. You just have to have your sensors out to hunt for them.
Appreciate what is right in front of you.
Yeah.
I guess. I mean, maybe I hold like whatever's hip in New York to a higher level, but. Yeah, I guess, you know, I understand. I'm just wondering, isn't Lou Donaldson like a legend?
Well, sure, but to some people, you know, if you knew that Travis Good was at the Cameron House, you know, just playing sideman for, right. You know, for an early evening gig, you'd be like, that guy's a legend, and he's there too.
Right.
He's played with, you know... Mm. Nico Case and Andre Williams and whoever else.
Right.
I was going to list off a bunch of people, then I stopped because I'm like, they played with everyone.
Right. Yeah, right. but yeah, I mean, that getting back to the whole Lou Donaldson list, your bucket list thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about that, and I don't know how many bucket list people I would see in the Village Voice.
Mm-hmm.
If I was to look today, and that could be me just getting older,
yeah,
getting more jaded and not appreciating like newer acts.
Yeah.
The same way I'm not appreciating local acts, mm-hmm. which now you've uncovered and made me feel like a sellout. but that's just how it is.
You don't have to love everything. I've certainly learned over the years that there are things I don't need to devote my time or attention to anymore. And, you know, there are a lot of bands who, you know, they may be breaking out and cool, but they may be cool because they just, I don't know, they're the coolest band on their campus. And they, you know, they catch a little bit of heat that way. And it's like, all right. You speak to a certain demo, you've got a lot of energy. Those songs aren't that good. You guys aren't that good. I probably don't need to invest too much time, you know, emotionally in you. You know, same with like the coolest band in your small town sort of thing. I see those all the time where we fill our Legion Hall, you know, twice a month. We're playing our cool shows and like, that's great. Like, you guys got hustle. Good for you. But you're not the best band in the big city, you know, and keep working at it, you have a chance.
Yeah.
But if you're not special in some unique or fascinating way to me, I'm not going to spend my time on you, because there's so many other things I can spend my time on. So.
Now, when you were, you know, editor of Chart, you kind of had to pay attention to them because of your job called for it, right?
Well, the one thing about Chart was, because we were for sale, we weren't a freebie magazine. Like, you actually had to give a compelling reason for people to spend $5 on you each month.
Right.
We were definitely we definitely target and were aware of what real people actually liked, you know, like what was actually popular, and popular in a genuine way, not in a trickster, you know, music industry way, but like what real people actually gave a crap about and, you know, would want to spend money on and had fans. And we made sure we did fan service. Like, I'm unapologetic about that. And I'm like, you know what? Yeah,
you have to stay in business.
Yeah, we have to eat, and we have to stay in business. And I don't actually conceptually understand why it would be offensive to people's sensibilities to not give music fans stories about the acts they like. So I have that side to me where it's like, I want to make sure we have to make sure that we were servicing people who cared about this stuff. But I was also, you know, I'd almost also be on my own musical journeys. You know, a lot of the acts I personally liked might have been smaller or might not have been able to push the needle as much. I got sweated so hard by so many friends and so many bands that I liked that, why don't you put us on the cover if you like us so much? Why don't I print 40,000 copies of my magazine just to throw them straight into a dumpster? You know, like,
yeah.
But I can't say that to people. But it's like, there's so many acts that I loved that I couldn't get onto the cover just because, like, they're not going to sell.
Yeah.
And that was the cruel part of it, about it. But the good part about it is in the inside pages, I could do a thing like put a 2-page story of Oasis right beside a 2-page story about, I don't know, King Cobb Steely or Flashing Lights or someone who's like, you know, not nearly as well known internationally or with no like success in that way. But if you give each of those two acts equal space, there's a you're saying to the readers, at least, look, this huge band that you came here for, there, take that article, enjoy it. This band you might not have heard of, they're just about as good. Check those guys out too. And I think we threaded that needle pretty well during those years.
Hmm. So you're saying you used to do this.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing now? You're still in music and you're still in,
yes,
you know, you still write, you're still editing. What are you doing now?
So these days I'm a freelance writer, so I'll do projects like your book.
Right.
I'll do sneaky behind the scenes things like write bios for acts. And I'll do the occasional, you know, music story or non-music story. But my main gig right now is helping out at the Polaris Music Prize, and I basically do the blog, all their social media, press releases, help on their podcast, do all sort of the outward facing communication-y kind of stuff. And it's not wildly different. I still have to deal with, you know, 200 music journalists and music media, you know, from across the country, you know, on a day-to-day basis, and, you know, deal with all their idiosyncrasies and everything, except now it's all in service of sort of promoting the records that they vote on and decide are awesome, instead of like assigning stories about those same records.
Right. Now, one thing I noticed about Chart Magazine back in the day was it was also a big booster for new writers, right? It also was kind of like sometimes a writer's first gig or first writing gig. So now that you're presiding over a certain part of the Polaris Prize with all these journalists, are some of these, like, you know, writers that used to write for you that you're well aware of and they're well acquainted with you and...
Yeah, it's
alumni
funny.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, there was a reason why we used young writers. There's a couple reasons. One, we wanted people who were of the age and of the scenes, you know, as much as possible to try to like dig up that sort of stuff. And I say that, you know, as an old, you know, grumpy old music writer now, who's like, you know, like, these kids, I can do that story better. But it was important for us to try to get that voice, and try to get like people that are deep in it, because they were the best at churning that stuff out, even if maybe they weren't polished writers. You know, if they knew the cool band, if you had a kid who knew every, you know, hardcore crust punk, you know, band that's playing the Big Bop,
right?
You know, or Reverb or whatever, and, you know, knew all those bands intimately. You know, I'm not going down there to do that.
Right.
You know, so, you know, you got to have someone that can, you know, get that. So right. That's one of the reasons why we'd always get that. Another reason is because we had a really strong contingent of women or female readership, we tried to get a lot of female writers too. It never reached 50-50, which was our idyllic, our ideal goal. But we, you know, if you sounded like you were halfway competent and halfway interested in contributing, and you're a woman, we'd probably try to give you a shot, because we wanted to make sure those voices were being served, you know, like you're serving your audience fairly. And then the other factor is we didn't pay very well. So that was one of the defaults, was you can get away with paying, you know, young new writers not very well. And then what would happen is the really good ones would just move on to bigger and better things. And it's like, I don't begrudge you, because you got to eat.
Yeah.
You know, I get it, and maybe we can bring them back for, like, to do a cover story. When I have real money, I can go, here, take X amount to do this cover story, and, or, I know you love this band, come on back and do this one.
Right.
And we generally would have enough goodwill to get people to come back under those circumstances, but that's why we had so many young and like emerging new writers, and there's so many of them out and about in the world now that they've just published their first book or their second book, or they just got a book deal, or they're now, you know, the main writer at whatchamacallit or Who's It, or just did a script for something or other.
Right.
So many of them have moved on to bigger and better things. Wow. So, you know, I'm not going to take much credit for it, but I know they have deep bylines buried early on where they probably said something when they were 20 that's probably embarrassing to them now. But I'm like, I remember when X wrote for us.
Yeah, I've been on the receiving end of a lot of those. You know, my relationship with a lot of these writers, it's hard to track writers from other countries. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's in another language, but you know, living, being from Canada, and you get to know the closed circle of writers.
Yeah.
Some of them that I had problems with, you know, just being the subject of whatever bias they threw at me. It's almost like 40-60, where 40% we've kind of come to terms or we're friends now and everything's cool. And then there's that 60% where I don't know where we stand.
Yeah.
And within that 60%, there's like maybe 25% like we are sworn enemies for life. I can put out Bohemian Rhapsody and you will shit on it. And I know you're going to shit on it.
Yeah.
So, it's an interesting, that's not really covered very much, the relationship between a band and writers.
Yeah, it's really weird. Because of the position I was in and kind of to this day the position I'm in, I rarely ever got, we'll say the true, sense of whether or not someone considered me an adversary. I get the meet and greet, hey, how's it going?
Yeah.
Like, I always got the meet and greet, hey, hello. And there'd be a few acts that, I personally adored that I became friends with. There's max a half dozen that I can say I'm genuinely friends with them and I genuinely like their music. And, even if they make a bomb of a record, I could maybe honestly tell them that and still consider them above. Nothing would change in my eyes. But everyone else, it was, very diplomatic, meet and greety. But I understand there's writers who would hate at certain people, and every now and then you'd let them have a go at an act. Yeah, and you'd just have to go, listen, whatever you write, you have to be able to win in an argument or have other people agree with you in an argument.
Yeah, that was my whole thing is like, hey, your opinion is valid. If you don't like the music, I'm not going to shit on you for not liking the music. There's lots of albums that I think suck too. Mm-hmm. But the cheap shots are what really got me.
And cheap shots are so fun to do. But you have to do them really well.
Yeah.
Touche.
I'm the first to say it.
Right. Like, your standard has to be like, if you do a cheap shot, it has to win a roast battle.
Right.
You can't just go, this is the suckiest suckitude in Sucktown.
Yeah.
Actually, that would be kind of funny if someone wrote that. But, we were also, from our perspective, we're also kind of a little bit on side. We're always 60% on side, mm-hmm. as opposed to being completely neutral. If you didn't hate a thing, be a little positive because all our people are fans. We weren't neutral. But if you truly hate something, say it. You're allowed to say it, but you got to be good at it because someone's going to come back at you. Their fans are going to come back at you. Girlfriends of the band members always come back at you. you have to be able to stand behind your words. And there's been a few times where I've had writers write terrible things written in a terrible way where it's like, God damn, I got to defend this guy. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to when their publicist calls up and yells at me, which would happen semi-regularly. Mm-hmm. But I got to defend my writer because if you don't defend your writers, then you don't have anything. So you're like, your writer said this and this. First of all, that's factually incorrect. Second of all, who says that about that? And then it's like, oh, man. Yep, I hear you and understand, but it's part of the game. I'm pretty sure at various points we were blacklisted from almost every major label. We were definitely blacklisted by House of Blues for a while. Sometimes you got to stand up for yourself and your convictions just to make sure you're doing what you thought was right.
Did you get off the blacklist eventually?
For most of them, yeah. You know, it just did put us in the penalty box. And then
I remember this one time. I got sweet revenge on this writer who for years had just shat on our band. Mm-hmm. Never met him. Shat on him. And he showed up to a gig, and I'm not going to say the gig because then he'll know who I'm talking about him. Uh-huh. But anyways, he thought he was going to be a smartass, and after the gig, he showed up with his laminate to get it signed. And on the laminate, it said his name. And he has such a distinct name. His name isn't Dave Smith. Mm-hmm. You know who it is if you see his name. And I looked at his name, I looked at him, and I looked at his hands holding the laminate, and they were shaking. He asked for me to sign it. And then I turned to JC, and JC knew this guy had just shat on our band. And the two of us together, we just bullied him. I just went to JC and I go, "Look, his hands are shaking." So I signed his laminate, and I wrote, "Are we cool now?" And that's basically, he took it to mean, like, are we friends now? Uh-huh. But I meant, do you think we're cool now? Because, you know, you're getting me to sign his autograph. But
was this a Canadian guy?
Yeah.
I don't want to
who it is, because I've actually emailed you going, what the fuck is this guy's deal?
So I've forgotten because we trash talk so many people so often secretly. But I don't want to ask you any more questions because then I'll know. And then
you know who he is.
And then I'll, we won't say anything more about this.
Yeah. But hey, listen, if that's fair game, I mean, not fair game, but if that's what it took to squash some sort of beef, maybe mm-hmm. saying this now reignites the beef, so be it. But I saw his hand shaking coming up to me. That was enough.
Yeah,
I was laughing. We laughed about that for the next couple of days. It's nice when it happens like that. But you know, I also feel like it's fair game. And being on the other side of, the curtain, writing, and mm-hmm. I have written reviews, and I have written mm-hmm. about bands for other magazines, and what I've said online as well, opinions expressed online about other bands and whatever, have landed me in hot water. Mm-hmm. So I know the feeling as well. But just like you were saying, I can back it up.
Yeah.
And what I find is, I lost respect for a very, very big band. And I said something about them. And it got back to them to hold on to what I think of one album when I can offset that by years of posting how big a fan I am mm-hmm. of their work. I feel like only a true fan gets to criticize, and that's how I felt I was.
Yeah.
And so I understand both sides, and I understand about, having a go at a band as well. I just like an album. If it's good, I like it. But I'm not going to, like, dive into you and your thing never again.
I mean, it's probably the right decision, though. I go to so many of these Before They Die shows where I see people having the greatest night of their lives, and I'm there to see three songs that I loved, and I'm like, yeah, Foreigner, I got to hear Jukebox Hero. Right. Cold as Ice, and I'm like, yeah, it doesn't matter to me that it's the substitute singer. That's great. And
he's amazing.
By the way. New Foreigner, they are genuinely great.
Yeah.
But I'm satisfied. I've scratched an itch. I can go, all right, that has happened. I'm set. But then there are people that are just swaying, and they might go to one concert in 5 years. You can tell. You can, they don't know how to get into their seats. They don't have navigate, around the venue or whatever.
Every merch item
is
they're wearing.
And they're having the best time. Like, this is fucking greatest moment. And I look at those people, and they're experiencing a joy and a fandom that I rarely get close to. And I'm out at shows every day. Well, not every day, but all the time. And I'm hunting for things that I know that I like. And I can't approach just that near religious experience they're feeling and go, like, you know what? You're having your moment. Go for it. You know, like, I'm glad that you're having that moment with that band. But I can't really reach that level very much anymore. So I get it like that.
Anymore, but you have.
Yeah. I understand it on a clinical level. And I'm close, you know. The right band with the right song, you know, I still get all the shivers and all the tingles and all the, you know, out of body, like, every ideal perfect reaction, I can still achieve that high, but it takes a lot of, like, I don't know, surgical precise targeting for me to find it.
Doesn't that automatically take all the fun out of it?
Sometimes it's a thankless quest, but I'm committed to it.
Right. Getting back to Foreigner, though, I think his name is Kelly. I can't remember his last name. Before he joined Foreigner, what was that guy's life like? Because he looks like Steven Tyler on his best day.
Yeah.
Steven Tyler's best day is his regular day. Kelly, I can't remember. Yeah. But what was he doing before? That's what I, when we played with Foreigner and I saw the show and I was like, why haven't we all known who this guy is?
Yeah.
If David Lee Roth didn't become David Lee Roth, he would still be this wild guy. You gotta meet this crazy wild dude who works at the you know, model airplane store. What was he doing every day? This guy would wake up. He's like Steven Tyler, like in the 70s, like, and he's an older dude too.
To me, it's got to be like that Charles Bradley phenomenon where. Mm. You know, it's like, man, that guy sounds like James Brown. Well, there's a reason why he sounds like James Brown. It's because he spent all this time, like, basically being a James Brown. And now that we've discovered him, he's great on his own. But, you know, like, those guys, they're everywhere. They just maybe never had the shot, or they were in the wrong bands, or they tried to write their own songs, and those songs were terrible, or they veered off and, like, I'm going to do a new country record. And it's like, no, your voice, you have the voice of someone who can do Freddie Mercury. You need to cut your hair short, grow a peculiar mustache, and do Queen, you know, until Brian May goes, we need a Queen singer. Let's have another contest. And that guy's a spitting image. We'll use him instead of Paul Rogers.
No, I think I'm going to stick with New Country.
Yeah.
That's what they usually end up.
Well, yeah, it's usually based on a series of bad decisions.
Yeah.
Until someone goes, you know what? If you want to eat, you're going to take this job being the singer of this band that gets to play sheds in the summer and just do it. And you'll make thousands of people happy. And that will be way better for your career, too.
Yeah. And it boggles my mind. And I'd love to know what he was doing before. I know nothing about him.
No, me
but
neither.
I don't think most people do, because he would have had X of such and such band after his name, you know. So I'm assuming he was plucked from obscurity.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but wow, he blew me away.
Yeah.
But yeah.
5 minutes on Foreigner. Who'd have thunk? There are a few fandoms who make fun of the bands of band members more than, say, Sloan. Like, if you know Sloan fans are relentless on those guys. But each and every one of those Sloan fans would die for the members of Sloan.
And I'm glad the Sloan guys are smart enough to know that.
Yeah.
Whereas other bands who are so huge, I'm going back to my previous story, yeah. whose egos have been like jerked off to the point where there's just no jerking off left, they cannot decipher
yeah.
this. I mean, I even tweeted Jay Ferguson over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see that post he did where he was?
I didn't.
He was DJing on the Wheels of Steel, and he was holding up these records. One was a Primal Scream record,
uh-huh.
and I go, are they really called Wheels of Steel if it's just twee? Mm-hmm. You know, if it's really all just twee? And then he goes, the Twheels of Steel, and I go, yeah, good one. So yeah, they can get it.
Yeah, they're a band I love. And
I love that band.
Yeah, and
all four guys, I think they're great dudes.
Yeah, and you know what? They have survived in Canada for so long, and they can eat doing what they do, and that's a rare and incredible, you know, thing. So
that double album they put out a few years back, maybe 5, 6, 7 years mm-hmm. back, is probably my favorite.
The one with all the 1 minute songs?
Yes. That's probably
my favorite. Yeah, that's a great record. Yeah. I'm presuming you've been on many bills with them. How many times do you think you've played with them?
Not too many.
Really? Like not like a Alston apple picking festival, you know, like
we don't do that circuit. They do that circuit. See what I mean? In jest, poking, fun.
Never mind. I love all those festivals. One of my jobs is I have to monitor every festival in the country to see what acts, Polaris nominated acts are playing them, so we can give them a little nudge and go, hey, the Salmon Festival in Salmon Arm, BC is having X Act playing Salmon Night. And wow, I'm really bad with repetition today.
Is that a real thing?
There's tons like that.
Right. Why do we play that?
My favorite is there's a one in Quebec. I think it's just outside of Montreal, so maybe one of the suburbs called the Poutine Festival, which
I will play that.
Which strikes me is the most ideologically perfect festival. A Poutine Festival.
It's got my name written all over.
And they always book great bands. Like they're really sharp booking. I'm like, man, one day I just want to get to that festival, eat a crap load of all kinds of poutine, watch some bands. Perfect.
I want to play that festival. See, that's the thing is, you know, the apple picking festival, salmon festival here in Canada. These are the festivals. These are the regional festivals. We don't get to play that. Instead, we're playing Summer Breeze Festival in front of like 30,000 people.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, I know. Sorry. Just a way to...
Yeah.
Another poke at Sloan in jest, tongue-in-cheek, but truly we are playing Summer Breeze, which is a humongous festival.
What date?
Actually, this podcast will be posted after we played the festival, but it's wasted, this Friday.
Wasted opportunity.
It's this Friday, though. And then the day after, we're playing... a festival in Holland with Uli John Roth.
Wow.
Yeah. Which is, I cannot wait for that. I cannot wait.
Oh, I have to ask on camera or on mic, how did your festival with Lee Aaron go?
Okay. This is the recap. It was amazing. Uh-huh. I had an in because her guitar player, Sean Kelly, is a guitarist about town.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody knows him, but we'd never met. We've only kind of emailed and tweeted each other.
Mm-hmm.
So there was my in. There was my excuse to get on stage and meet Sean. And hey, you got to meet Lee. Well, yeah, I might as well. It's been only like decades that I've wanted to. So she was great. And she was talking to me like a minute and a half before on the stage that they were playing, a minute and a half before showtime, I was like, shouldn't I leave and let you get in the zone? And she was like, nah.
No, she's a pro. She's unfazed. She doesn't need your cone of silence. No. I need to concentrate, get into character, psych out time.
She is always there.
Right? Yeah.
But they started with Metal Queen. which was wow. And then they ended with "What You Do to My Body," which is perfect. I mean,
yeah,
great bookends. So yeah, and the whole band was really nice, and she was very nice. But they had had a 25-hour plane delay getting to the festival, so they were a bit beat, and
yeah,
they had to, you know, they stayed for a little bit, but we were playing later on. They couldn't wait. So
you can put in your bio shared stage with Metal Queen.
Technically, no. She played the other stage. There's two stages, and they would kind of, when one stage is finished, they, so we played the other stage.
Having written numerous bios, that does not
matter. Also, yeah, that night, we headlined over Mr. Big, but we all know we closed the night. It's different, but, you know, I'll just say that.
Yeah.
It was Mr. Big and then us.
Yeah.
Their, what is it, 10 million sold song, what is that, that's played in every wedding,
I don't know.
Be with you.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah, you say you don't know it.
No,
but when you hear it, everybody knows it.
Yeah,
it's a all na to be with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, thank you for putting that in my head.
It will stay there for the rest of the day.
When that came out, and the age I was at, I would have been defining myself against those, like, no, man, none of that right. ballad shit.
Slint.
Thrash.
Oh, thrash. Yeah, right. Nuclear assault, man.
Yeah.
But let's be honest.
Suicidal tendencies.
I love Mr. Big, and I love Suicidal Tendencies, and I love Poison, but I also love Slayer. It's now there's no sides anymore.
No, it is definitely, I find those arbitrary lines silly now, especially, you know, the older I get as a music fan, and I'm just hunting, you know, it's not necessarily hunting for the new sounds, you know, I don't need, like, this guy takes his laptop and then sets it on fire, records the melting wires, and then cuts those up in, you know, a program, and those become the digital beats. I'm like, I don't need that as my process. I just need to be directed towards the good. You know, I like a certain amount of intensity. I like acts that say something. You know, you can say something, you know, the most outlandish thing, or the funniest thing, or the stupidest thing, or maybe even the wrongest thing, but say it with some genuineness. That's what I care about. Just point me in the way of those bands, you know, and that they're doing it well in an interesting way.
You just gave your conclusion to your podcast here, your guest appearance on the podcast. This is the best way to end.
If those are my last words, so be it.